Hello and welcome to episode 154 of The Great and Crowbar. It's the 24th of August, 2016. My name is Chris Thurston and tonight I'm joined by Pip War.
Hi.
And Tom Senior.
Well, hello.
Again.
Yeah, sorry. Tom,
Francis is back soon, though.
He's very soon. Days away. Save us, Tom. Save us from ourselves. Tell us about puzzle games I don't understand. No, we're very glad to have him back. But then he's going on holiday almost immediately afterwards.
He's going on holiday from his... But he's...
He'll be on one pod, I think.
Yes, he'll be on next week's podcast and then he'll be away again. But we're going to scout out some guests so we don't have to spend quite so much time with our shit opinions. Speaking of... let's go on to shit news. So what's happened this week in the world of computer and... Video games.
I mean, I went to a disused power station / nature reserve, so I don't really think that I'm the best place to talk about gaming news.
The best place.
Best placed,
I see.
I thought you were about to say that was a press trip of some kind. I was desperately trying to figure out what amazing
that would
game
be
amazing, that was.
Amazing, wouldn't combine it? Combine
the two. Oh. It'd be like a stalker thing.
I miss stalker.
I miss stalker as well.
I mean,
there's always Jim's new game. You just rely on Jim to be somewhere in the world making stalker.
Jim Roswell's game. Have we mentioned it on the pod yet?
I don't think so. The signal from Tolva.
I'd forgotten the name completely.
I just remembered it in time to save this bit.
It looks really cool, though. It seems like a massive Chris Voss kind of sci-fi influence on it. It's kind of survival game, but with robots.
You are controlling... Yes, it's a game about exploring a mysterious planet where you beam into you are controlling a robot remotely. Which is sort of how it handles, player death and stuff like that.
That makes sense.
Yeah, and there's some sort of trailer that I've seen, that I have actually, that makes it sound like I'm lying, but I'm not. I just sound untrustworthy. That's great and very exciting. And I don't say that simply because, Jim's a mate, because it genuinely does look exciting.
Yeah, looks sweet. I love that sci-fi.
Me too.
Good sci-fi things happening this week, though.
Very good.
For it is the week of Deus Ex, Mankind Divided.
Indeed. Deus Ex is out. Just in time for the hot No Man's Stick. No Man's Sky takes to finally cool down.
It's good. The one controversial sci-fi game has been replaced by the other controversial sci-fi game. And the internet is once again enraged because of pre-order bonuses that are consumables or something. But I mean, maybe we can get onto that later, but I'd rather talk about the game.
Yeah, so Tom, you have played all of it?
Yeah, I played all of it. I reviewed it for Games Master. And what happens with PC Gamer is that everyone in the office, when a Deus Ex Gamer is released, hires each of us individually to write reviews for them for their separate outlets.
We are the secret knowledge base for games, where you might get an event.
Yes. If you're getting an event, PC Gamer staff are reviewing it for you, basically. And the same, I'm sure, Dishonored 2.
That's why I have written four different retrospectives on Dishonored 1 really? This year.
Amazing. Wow.
Who should we get to write about this?
It's interesting.
Today, someone from Edge came around to be like, to ask questions about Dishonored.
Really?
Not to anyone specific on PC Gamer, just to the ambient PC Gamer desk area.
If you've got a question about an immersive sim, just honk it into the PC Gamer aura, and it will be answered by the hive mind in some way. It's such a PC Gamer kind of, I feel like, not ownership, but a kind of, PC Gamer's always been obsessed with this sort of game. And the things that these games represent, particularly as sandbox constructs and ways that games that let you kind of inhabit a cool fantasy, but also express yourself in some way at the same time. And it's very interesting to play Deus Ex Mankind Divided, knowing that Dishonored 2 is on the horizon, a game that I suspect will be better, actually, in a lot of ways, and more inventive, particularly with its aesthetic and with its abilities and with its world. But nonetheless, I got a huge thrill out of walking through Prague at night with its kind of hanging, fluorescent, weird light constructs and strange, deeply meaningful statues, like the stone tree holding up a big cube. meaningful.
Is that symbolic of mankind's transition from nature to a big cube?
To a big cube, yeah, that's right. Everyone is cube now.
From nature to Borg.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a good Deus Ex game, I think. It's got all the things that you expect from a Deus Ex. That bit where there's like a fridge-sized object and you pick it up and move it and there's a vent behind it and then you go in the vents. That's like, all that stuff is alive.
Did you have to upgrade your arms before lifting the fridge-sized object?
Yes! It's right on point, right on point. hacking, really nice hacking minigame stuff. You know, the main thing is just beautiful levels with loads of ways through them that are kind of small and intricate, but also just covered in detail with guards that are kind of just stupid enough to be fun to mess with. It feels like Deus Ex once you get into it. It's got a really, really duff intro mission with this, like, a terrible sandstorm fight, and it's got some awful, awful dialogue and some terrible voice acting in it as well. Like, even like some of the worst in the series, which is extraordinary.
That's an amazing
claim. I know. I mean, I think I might be personally a bit too sensitive to this, but like your boss. So Jensen works at Interpol now. There's just to catch people up briefly with the kind of context of it. It's the future. People have augmented limbs. At the end of Deus Ex Human Revolution, the incident happens, and the incident causes people's limbs to go crazy, and people with augmentations start killing their friends, and everything goes mad. And this game is set 2 years afterwards. Everyone is very cross with the people with metal limbs now, on account of all the killing.
Surely they're cross with the limbs, not the people. Well, I don't want to come over like a bit NRA on this.
But racism happens. Oh. And suddenly...
Shit.
Like, you need to, like... If there's a big, like, racism analogue there to be taken, and Eidos Montréal have gone for it really in a slightly embarrassingly intense way. So they've created, there's a segregated society now, and it's called they called it the mechanical apartheid. And
oh god,
Pip's already just slumping down in her seat.
Well, I saw some of this at E3 last year when they showed bits and pieces, or, you know, were doing interviews and things. So I did know a bit about it, but yeah, just it feels really cringy. And like, have they answered any of the more interesting aspects of that? Like, surely the people who would have the augmentations would be more well off, and therefore, like, what, how does that affect the
thing? Is it's a cyberpunk future where regardless of what economic class you belong to, you own a really cool coat and there are lights in your skin. And that's true regardless of the maintenance cost.
And that's enough to be persecuted.
But I guess it just feels to me like, from everything that I saw, it wasn't... I don't know. Like, there were some actual really interesting questions that you could probably have explored with it, but I didn't really get the feeling that it was doing that.
If they'd have explored the issue of human augmentation and transhuman progress and how that might change society, it would be successful. What they've done is they've just very cheaply taken, you know, racial segregation and imposed this sci-fi thing onto it, and it doesn't work at all.
No.
Like, the first question is really interesting, and loads of science fiction literature is fascinated about unpicking, you know, what humans will do if humans stop being humans. And,
well, yeah,
even the first game, I'm sorry, not the first game, even, but Human Revolution puts some thought into that and has some things to say about it
for sure. Human Revolution lets you express different responses as Jensen to what's happened to him as a guy who's had his arms blown
famously
off.
Famously, he can not have asked for it.
He didn't ask for it, but at least you get to say that, you know, I didn't ask for it, but it was quite nice, actually. Or you get to say, I didn't ask for it, and it's horrible. And, you know, that gives you a little bit of authorship over your character, and it gives Jensen a lot of authorship and kind of character. And both of those things are missing from Mankind Divided, and its story and its kind of conspiratorial stuff, and the dialogue and a lot of the other stuff is by far the weakest aspect of it. Like, you're working for Interpol, and the Interpol commander is just this loud idiot who the voice is so bad on him. Like, the performance just clearly hasn't been told where he's standing or what he's who he's addressing or what he's trying to say to someone. So he's busting your balls all the time, no matter what he's saying. He's always just like, "Oh, Jensen, there's a threat in the city of Prague, and, you know, you need to sort this out. You go over there and do whatever you've got to do to take it out." And then Jensen will say something like, "So this complicated political situation, are you talking about ARC? Are they the real terrorists? What are you talking about?" And he's just like, "No, I don't care. Just go over there and be a cyborg, you bastard." It's just this relentless shouting at Jensen that doesn't make any sense. And he's the head of fucking Interpol in Prague. He's supposed to be this intelligent, you know, really savvy intel officer. And he's just a moron.
Is he struggling with robophobia or something, whatever they would call it?
I wish that that was actually a part of his character. Everyone's sort of suspicious of Jensen because
that's robot arms.
Because I have robot arms and he wears shades indoors and it's a bit weird. And that, you know, but again, that's a line in and of itself because you're not an augmented person in this world. You're a special augmented person who basically occasionally people will try and, you know, oppress you for being augmented, but then you're Adam Jensen, so it's fine. Because they're like, wow, you're augmented, but God, look at how military and amazing your augments are. So I'm scared of you now. So the logic is, come on through.
We hate and fear and oppress augmented people because one time someone's prosthetic leg made them go crazy. But the man who's literally got guns and knives and rockets and exploding million tiny bombs in his body is fine.
Yeah, they're like, wow.
Surely that's the one you'd be most prejudiced against.
Yeah, I mean,
the actual bomb man.
The way the game communicates this to you is that there are subway stations that you go into, and when you go downstairs, there's like a naturals staircase, side of the staircase, and an augmented side of the staircase. And it's your choice which one you go down. So if you go down the augmented side, no one bothers you and it's fine. Go down the natural side. Someone checks your ID, and then they look at your ID, and they go, holy shit, you must be some sort of Superman, and then they let you through. So the whole kind of, it's still like a huge player power fantasy that completely just disintegrates any sort of point they're trying to make about this two-tiered society. Because you're supposed to be on the bottom tier of the society, but nothing about the game actually, you're never inhibited. You are the total Superman of, like, I pressed Q to knock out the guard that checked my ID and the AI did nothing. I came back through that same area 2 hours later and that guard was still lying on the floor in the train station, unmoving. Aww. And I don't know, it felt good, to be honest. But at the same time, that's where the game really fails in what it's trying to do and what it's trying to say with its story. And the story itself is just a load of kind of, as Deus Ex always is, it's about a load of dumb, layered conspiracy stuff that take it or leave it, whatever. But the game itself, the kind of the sneaking and the cool gadgets and how awesome your arms look when you're in first person doing stuff, you know, all these things I really enjoyed about it. And I will complain about it that it's negative to a lot, but it's still a solid Deus Ex game, I think.
It sounds like, from what you were saying about the staircases thing, like they're kind of intending it as like segregated water fountains moment, but how it comes across is one of those incredibly vapid but pretending to be meaningful, you know, like the Dove advert where they put beautiful over one door and like people didn't go through it because they didn't believe in themselves. And then because of the power of, I don't know, advertising and soap or something, then they suddenly like walk through it and then they have a moment and maybe a little cry and everyone feels better and pleased by some soap.
Yeah. Except in this it's like, I am beautiful, my metal arms are beautiful and I will kill more people than ever with them.
God, imagine if he turned into a beautiful metal butterfly and flew away.
I think what they were trying to do was create a kind of sense of a repressive bureaucracy around you that where you can't even go through here without being checked or whatever, but like the oppression's quite a bit worse than that. Like the oppression they're kind of evoking and the stuff they're tapping into is just way, way worse than what the sort of...
It seems like a really politically inopportune time to get into that as well.
Definitely, it's a good point, actually.
It's like, yeah. Oh, you know, do you guys remember a history of racial oppression during the 20th and, to be honest, well into the 21st century? Mm. What if you were a magic white guy with rocket arms? Yeah. How hard would that be?
I think it's such a missed opportunity because... the Human Revolution was so excited about technology. Like, even though it was, Jensen had a complicated relationship with it, fundamentally, the way it was portrayed in the universe has been this super exciting, like, humans could be better, and what does that mean? And, you know, should we embrace it? And you are in this position, and how are you going to deal with it? And those are really cool, exciting questions, especially someone who loves sci-fi. And I'm personally generally very optimistic about technology in a lot of context anyway, especially when it's kind of world improving stuff.
And that's there'll come a time when you can never forget a chisel, Tom. You've always got two.
That's true. And isn't that a great thing? Isn't that a thing exactly. We should all aspire to? And yet, mankind divided, that's been turned on its head. And actually, just technology is another vehicle for shit human behavior. And it's just kind of grim. And even though it's beautiful and it's a really cool, great game, and I scored it in the 80s because just to play, it's loads of fun just to infiltrate those facilities. And then the bank level is fantastic. The bank they've constructed in Prague is beautiful. And just cracking open those little safes they've made for you with your superpowers is really, really fun. Just feels like a lot of the kind of the aesthetic and the narrative apparatus around it has faltered since the last game, which seemed to be a lot more intelligent in a lot of ways.
It's interesting because the first game has what I thought was quite like a compelling idea at the start. I mean, it's very Deus Ex-y, and that's within the context that it's going to be about layered conspiracies and robot men and the happenings of them. Like the fact that you're sort of working for basically like a private startup making orgs, but are happily augmented until your boss decides to kind of graft this stuff to you, basically as a pilot program to demonstrate some stuff. So there's all these ideas about how this technology, which should absolutely be military or maybe like state controlled because you are a former policeman and that kind of thing, is sort of completely at the behest of, you know, individual corporate capitalists that will ultimately determine who gets it and for what and so on. It's kind of an interesting question to ask about that, particularly when it concerns what being human means, which is like a problem question it gets to towards the end. And admittedly, the incident stuff is silly, but
yeah, that was really interesting as well, because that is deeply relevant to current, like the Silicon Valley and how, you know, the tech disruptors of the technocracy that exists in Silicon Valley exercises a lot of power that, you know, people are starting to question and challenge. And, you know, it's as a government versus private enterprise battle for control in a lot of spheres, like privacy and technology. And if the first game, perhaps by accident, stumbled upon those and, you know, that made it more interesting. Whereas this one has kind of gone into a different place and kind of mindlessly attempted something else.
It's interesting because, like, good cyberpunk, I think, often escalates the power that corporations have and starts to blur those lines. Like, I think that's a really important sort of founding tenet of a lot of cyberpunk fiction, is that very increasingly blurry line between private business and state-style power, right? But, like, always sort of pushes it to an extreme and kind of tries to stretch the idea of what, like, a corporate interest could be. That's the kind of big through line. So that's, like, you know, there's a nice piece of writing I like there. Can't remember who wrote it because there's enough articles about this on the web, but about sort of Silicon Valley culture and startup culture in the US, and how one of the issues with it is that sort of quote unquote disruptive startups specialize in solving problems that occur to people who run disruptive startups. So those problems include, like, how can I get a cab really quickly? And how can I get around the hotel system that I don't really enjoy, and that kind of thing, not problems that might occur to people who don't have the income to have those problems and so on. And that's something that I think good cyberpunk fiction pushes quite far, is like, well, what does a corporation need in 2027, whatever year Deus Ex Human Revolution is set in? It's like, well, actually David Sarif needs an invisible lethal enforcer that he privately owns, that he can drop into situations that he needs to control, and here's why. And that's why, you know, you're being parachuted in as Adam Jensen to resolve a situation that should be for the police on behalf of your boss. And obviously, it's all silly video game stuff, and it's the reason for you to be the protagonist in the place.
Yeah.
But there's still kind of a nice, interesting sort of philosophical line there, because it's dealing with problems that don't exist yet, really. Whereas the phrase mechanical apartheid is like, tells you everything about that, because you're just taking something terrible from history and putting robot in front of it, which is the issue, right? It's not really futuristic science fiction. It's like robot historical fiction.
But they haven't extrapolated based on the technology, like their what's happened in their world. They haven't extrapolated correctly to what the social problems would necessarily be. They've just simply borrowed, like, taken wholesale this, you know, apartheid. And yeah, it doesn't work. Also, it's really insensitive in a lot of ways. And, you know, I know that people get grumpy about the people finding the stuff insensitive, but at the same time, you know, be smarter about it. It could be a smarter world, and it could be a more interesting world for it. And it's sad that it's not that. And it's kind of interesting to compare it to Human Revolution, particularly based on what you were just saying, Chris, because I think for those reasons, Sarif was a really interesting character, particularly the way that he was acting, the way that he was kind of this personage when you met him. Like, he was utopian. He's like this misguided utopian. And not necessarily misguided, he just really believes in, you know, bettering humanity and, you know, disrupting things in order to better things. And that's a very Silicon Valley type. You hear that type of ideology coming through again and again in a lot of, you know, speeches that Elon Musk's make.
He's a TED talk waiting to happen.
Yeah, absolutely. And by the way, he has a much better outfit in Mankind Divided.
That's good news.
Yeah. So that, though, just getting back to the really important things.
On that, actually, how is the art direction? Because you said it looks great, but that was one of the things that I think people forget now, that was really striking about Human Revolution, was that Deus Ex was a phenomenal game that people loved, and Invisible War was what it was. But people Deus Ex had never been a pretty game,
at the time. It was ugly, wasn't it?
Then suddenly Human Revolution had this whole aesthetic that was really, really striking.
Yeah, and people took the piss out of it at the time. Lots of internet comments about the piss filter and stuff, but I really respected their commitment to really putting, giving even their colour palette its own unique stamp. That this is Deus Ex Human Revolution because simply the colours on the screen and the golds and the reds.
Well, I mean, it is about a man who is permanently wearing golden shades.
That is true.
So it will be gold.
It will be gold forever. Yeah, and it's interesting, actually, because in Mankind Divided, it feels like they've thrown everything at the wall in a way that it feels less kind of directed and refined than Human Revolution. And nonetheless, it's a relentlessly spectacular world if you like sci-fi stuff. And the big central hub, which is pretty much the only big hub of the game, and it is big, that has a load of cool stuff to recommend it. They've chosen Prague, which is obviously this old, beautiful European city. And I was there a few months ago, just on holiday, and it's just a beautiful, astonishing place. And it was really interesting because they kind of massacre it with technology and ads in a way that's quite intentional, I think. So there are these glass facades that sit over the front of these beautiful old buildings, and they'll suddenly go completely opaque and flash you an ad for an insurance company, and then it will fade and you'll see the beautiful old brickwork again. And it's they've put jerky pop-up ads onto architecture. And that's an interesting and quite funny idea. The idea that, you know, everything that is irritating and annoying about cyberspace and the bombardment of information that we have would then in the future somehow just become corporeal and actually just overlaid onto everyday objects, even if they are these beautiful, hundreds and hundreds of years old structures. And there's a lot of kind of really cool stuff they do with that. But at the same time, it's very stagey. It's very, very stagey. It's like, oh, wow, look, someone's made an amazing piece of concept art and then we've rendered it perfectly. There's not much thought as to what people would actually build in these spaces because it's quite a small space. So it's a small, very dense, full of lots of different ideas. One street, there's a big stupid rock just hanging over the street that's chained to all the buildings around it for no reason. And it feels like some of these ideas would perhaps have been cut. But at the same time, it still makes it quite a magical place to walk around, or at least just a constantly inspiring place. It's just like, oh, there's a new thing and there's a new thing. And it changes a lot with the time of day. It's not terribly impressive when you first get into it. But when you kind of go back to Prague and it's nighttime, then it's suddenly, wow, this feels like a Deus Ex game now. This feels like a cyberpunk nighttime neon kind of glowing place. So I was overall just I'm happy with it as a sci-fi fan, as a fan of kind of cyberpunk aesthetic, even though I think it was a little bit directionless, perhaps. A little bit just kind of scattershot, which is fine.
It sounds like that gets a bit closer to that sort of cyberpunk thing, though, of showing how technology invades and takes over stuff with corporate interest behind it.
Yeah, and I love the bank again, the Palisade Bank, because it's this enormous obelisk. It just towers over everything. And the whole idea of it is that it houses the secrets of the rich and powerful global elite in this huge kind of sarcophagus. And it's just totally different to all the other architecture in the city. It's like it's been just plonked there by the world. And it's a really powerful image. It's a windowless thing that you have to infiltrate and break into. And there's occasionally just really powerful moments like that. And you go to Gollum City and that's just this slum, this cesspit of human living that is quite impressive just simply for the detail it packs in. And you go into this place called The Throat, which it's almost like it's based on the Kowloon walled city.
Mm.
And it's just almost just endless stacked containers that people live in now. And that's just quite a good dark vision of, you know, confined living as well. So you're constantly confronted by these things. I do wish there was more than one major hub, just simply because I associate Deus Ex with globetrotting and seeing a lot of different things. And they tease you with a lot of cool concepts that you don't necessarily see as well. So it feels like sequel bait in a way, like you're being kind of teased little crumbs that will hopefully be in another Deus Ex game.
Surely it's going to catch up with Deus Ex 1 at some point.
Yeah, I mean, it's 2029 it's set in. So I think it's still got like 20 or 30 years before it hits the Deus Ex timeline. And they're already introducing characters from Deus Ex that are in Mankind Divided in there, looking much younger, obviously. So they're going to hit there eventually. I don't know what they're going to do. I think if they do 2-year increments, obviously, it's fine. But if they have to remake Deus Ex, that would be very interesting. I wonder how they would approach that.
Mm. It sounds like it's interesting to try and pick apart why the art, because like cyberpunk is always political. That's why it's got the punk bit in why it's called cyberpunk. But it's always like there's always a danger with any cyberpunk story that like it's always spectacular and very demonstrative and very theatrical in how it presents the future in a way that can go, it can err on the side of Banksy, I put it that way, right? Like, but most of the time you sort of accept that's part of the genre, and I was sort of trying to unpick why this Deus Ex's particular interpretation of social divide and segregation and prejudice and stuff isn't that, but is actually something sort of distracting and worse.
I think because a lot of the cyberpunk I love, a lot of those issues are just a kind of background noise where the main plot won't necessarily kind of have the protagonist going, you know, I think all this segregation is wrong and, you know, this, that and the other. Like in Blade Runner, the kind of the way people are kind of packed like sardines in a, you know, this tiny tin box of a city and the smoke and the poison of it. That's just it always in the background. And actually it's a very straightforward hard-boiled detective story with nemesis and stuff like that in some ways, that is told over that kind of background noise and over that baseline. And I think the difficulty is that the way that the baseline is presented to you is like little plays that happen as you walk past them in Mankind Divided. So you have Prague and you walk past, and then it's almost as though the police officers that are about to kick the shit out of this guy have been waiting for you to turn up. And then as soon as you get within their range, they start doing the oppression dialogue, and then they start kicking the shit out of the guy. And it's not background stuff when that happens. It's not background because it's like the designer's shouting loudly at you, like, this is what the game is about, this is what the world is, and it's not just like this experiential thing anymore. And maybe I'm just experiencing that as someone who's just played fucking loads of games and recognizing the kind of the cues of it and the artificiality of it when I actually see it. Maybe if you're playing this and you haven't just reviewed games for years, you would just experience it and you'd get that in a different way. But for me, a lot of it felt quite stagey and also just really blunt and on the nose in a way that oversold its Banksiness.
I think
too Banksy.
It's interesting because that maybe because there's this, you know, you're right. Like Blade Runner is a really good comparison. And I think more broadly, like the noir angle is kind of a useful one because like noir, for whatever reason, tends to like ignore, present, but like not do anything about the problems of its day, right? Yeah. Like it's kind of about powerlessness or not powerlessness, but like that sort of outsider, well, there's nothing to be done about that.
Yeah,
like
forget it, Jake, it's Chinatown.
Yeah,
right?
Forget it, Jake, it's Robot Chinatown.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly.
Like, and there's a sort of, you know, maybe that's the problem. I mean, I'm trying to pick an issue with a game that I have only seen marketing material for, so it's hard.
I think the difference is that, honestly, the time you spend with that world hugely changes how that works. So with Chinatown or Blade Runner, where there are similar themes with this kind of, you know, nihilist that you can't change anything, there's always human corruption, there's always misery. And you can perhaps solve a tiny problem and make someone's life a little bit better. But ultimately, this is broken society. Look at it. And, okay, looking at it for 2 hours is fine. Looking at it for 30 hours is a very different experience. And it's becomes, especially in video games, where you almost expect to have more agency than the cyberpunk fiction allows you. So you're not going to be like a world-changing presence. A lot of the reason why I think Deus Ex endings are so stupid is that they present cyberpunk realities and then give you the fix button at the end.
Yeah.
And that's, no, I feel like the genre just won't
work. It's the end of Chinatown, but at the end, Jake gets into a room with three buttons, and one of them is destroy Chinatown.
Yeah.
And one of them is, like, save Chinatown.
One of the fuse with Cybertown.
Chinatown.
Yeah. To run it more effectively.
Yeah, so, and then one is, like, AI. Revert Chinatown to Big Farm.
Yeah. It's interesting how just a video game, if you stretch that concept out and then try and deliver a kind of video gamey power trip at the same time, it really breaks the genre in a lot of interesting ways. Having said that, I still think they just could have told a better story.
Yeah.
Like the story itself, the noir story over it, just should have been better. And it's a bit sad that you just can't care about Jensen even, because I know Jensen's just a very traditional gruff protagonist in a lot of ways, but I think there was something to him. There's a bit of spark of humour or something to him in Human Revolution that I think is completely lacking.
There's a sort of underdog quality to him in Human Revolution, which might be the key to it. And it's not, I mean, I know I didn't ask for this, has become a bit of a joke. And some of the unintentional humour of Human Revolution comes from, like, a dour man who's down on his luck trying to deal with the fact that he has exploding robot arms. Like, because it's not a disability. And any you know, that he has, he's super able. That's the whole deal with Adam Jensen. He loses all four of his limbs, but comes back able to fucking fly.
Yeah.
Like, it's a power fantasy. It's not a disempowerment fantasy by any meaningful stretch. He doesn't even pretend to be one.
The fiction says that people who are augmented have to take neuropathy constantly in order to, so that their bodies don't reject their augmented limbs. But Adam Jensen is a medical miracle who never has to take neuropazine ever, because it's a power fantasy. And like, if you're actually going to try and say something about the situation, he can't have any of those advantages. You've got to be put into this.
But like, there's still a degree to which he is an underdog. Like, you know, he's sort of the pawn of this, you know, his corporate overlords at the start, and trying to break out from that is difficult. And he has like really one real ally in Malik, who's a really good character. And, and you have that, like, there is a sort of, you know, and even like, even the partner that he's pining for, spoilers for Human Revolution if you haven't played it or whatever, but like, he's being manipulated by the person that he feels like he's lost. Like, that's quite a noirish sort of flourish to Human Revolution, is that, you know, Jensen gets to mope around like glowering in the dark, going like, you know, my girlfriend was murdered by Illuminati dickheads, but she wasn't. And she, you know, and she's been sort of running a circle around him the entire time, which is like, all that stuff sort of plays into that, like, nihilism and feeling of being lost in the middle of this big operation. Whereas if you're like the magic Interpol man, maybe that's a bit harder. You're closer to JC Denton again.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah. I mean, it's a new expectation that's come to Deus Ex, really, because the Deus Ex plots have never been good. The first Deus Ex story is just fucking awful, isn't it?
First Deus Ex was really good for its time. I think I think the whole, like, even though it became really cliche, the double cross sequence and, you know, all of that environmental storytelling that paid off in this big moment where you have to fight through a place that you previously seen as safe and all that stuff.
That's right. Actually.
And like Paul's bedroom and like trying to get him out. That and was losing great, your brother. Like, yeah, there's lots of good. It's not Chinatown, but it's not, by the standards of the time, for a shooter storyline, it's pretty fucking amazing.
Yeah, like, true, actually. Yeah, that's a good point.
It's quotable as well. Like, there's, you know, Gunter and Anna and...
Yeah, jokes. Like, actual funny comedy, which is totally missing in Mankind Divided. Just right, relentlessly serious.
So,
interesting game, though.
One thing I wanted to ask before we wrap up on Deus Ex, because I appreciate it's been a long old Deus Exing, is playing non-lethally more fun? Because that's the problem that I think Dishonored 2 is doing interesting things to solve. But it's my big problem with the last generation of these games is, here are a million toys, 80% of them kill people, but the way everyone wants to play is as a stealthy assassin, so here's your two toys.
Playing stealthily is more fun still. What they've done is they've made aspects of playing stealthily feel more like a shooter. And more like the action game that you would expect to play as a shooter. So the Typhoon bomb move now has a gas variant. So you could play stealthily and just spray gas from your shoulders instead. And that's the non-lethal variant, but you still get to do the cool thing you do in your shooter.
You spin around with a big coat on.
That's right. And then everyone goes, oh, no, he you did the spinny move, if only...
I'm sleepy now.
Yep. So that's kind of how it gets around it. Like, the shooting is better, but you don't want to play this game as a shooter, because if you just approach it as a straight shooter, it's just play Wolfenstein instead. You know, I mean, it's never going to get close to that. But the kind of non-lethal guns they have are really satisfying to fire and feel more like guns, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
Then trank darts and the little kind of sparky taser thing they have feels really nice to fire. They've just kind of basically made those non-lethal moves feel more satisfying. But nonetheless, it's more satisfying to be stealthy, for sure.
Hang on. This might be a leading question, but which, out of Deus Ex, Mankind Divided, and Wolfenstein The New Order, which is a better depiction of a dystopian kind of alt future where people are persecuted?
That's a really interesting question, actually.
Because one of them's a Wolfenstein game.
I know, right, yeah. But Wolfenstein's surprisingly good at that.
Yeah, it is surprisingly good at it. I mean, it has the egregious, very uncomfortable in some ways, concentration camp sequence. But even then, it has a lot of heart. I don't know.
I think, Wolfenstein's a better story because I think it's far better at generating investment in the characters that you talk to and who you are in that world.
Than... and you're a man called BJ.
I know, right? But it's far better at doing that than Mankind Divided. It really is. And it's an interesting question, that, actually. I think maybe Wolfenstein benefits from not necessarily having to show you so many people. So a lot of shooter levels, you're just going through corridors and killing bad guys. And occasionally you... like the concentration camp level, you do see beyond that, whereas Deus Ex constantly has to show you society all the time because it's hub-based, and that does change the way that the world is kind of communicated to you. And there's nowhere to hide for Deus Ex when it does that because, you know, it's a bit easier for Wolfenstein, but Wolfenstein is underrated, I think, for its storytelling.
Yeah, or even just its atmosphere.
Yeah.
There's definitely an atmosphere of being persecuted and oppressed by Nazi robo-dogs.
I know. I mean, it's big dumb video game stuff, but I do care about BJ and, like, his quest. And
he's never going to go to that barbecue. And in a lot of ways, we all got to make our peace with that.
His weird kind of melancholy internal monologue was...
It's an interesting through line because Adam Jensen is a man who'll go like, I don't want to do this. Mm. Well, he's like propelling chisels out of his arms. And BJ Blazkowicz is a man who'll have the world's biggest shotgun in each hand, walking into battle with a Nazi laser robo electro tank on a blimp or something, while going like, you know, back home on the ranch. We used to bring the cattle in every morning and like blows three. That world is gone.
He really gives a shit about what he's
he
doing.
He does give a shit, though. Like, yeah.
That's the difference. That's the fundamental difference, is that Jensen is doing a job, and he might just be, like, he might be gathering intel, but he's a professional all the time. And in Human Revolution, like, he had stake because he cared about Megan, and he cared about, you know, what had been done to him, and he had personal investment in that and what was going on for most of that story. And that is all relegated to a side quest in Mankind Divided. Jensen goes for a checkup and they find magic augmentations inside him that he never knew existed. And then he was like, oh, I remember now. I spent 6 months unconscious. Maybe that's when it happened.
That did happen in...
Yeah, that in... stems from the end of... it stems from the previous game. But that's what he cares about. It's like, who put this shit in my body? That's a really good, you know, there's a lot of stake. He has a lot of stake in that question. And
it's like he woke up after a house party with his eyebrows shaved off.
That's right. He's
a new pair of deployable eyebrows.
Those side missions are far more interesting because I want to know who put this shit in his body as well. Like, what the hell, man? Like, that's just uncalled for. And whereas all the kind of the conspiracy shit is like, oh, you know. It's politics in a world that doesn't make any sense.
It's not electronic old men in the city on the hill.
It is electronic old men in the future, prod with a prod. We should link that video in the show notes. It's amazing.
I think that's Deus Ex.
Yeah.
I was just going to ask, because I asked it of Alice when we were talking about Deus Ex, Mankind Divided, that because last year brought Phantom Pain, and that to me, as somebody who doesn't play Deus Ex games, sounded like, oh, you know, you can do things stealthily, you can have different outcomes from missions, there are different ways of doing things, you can, you know, do all of the things that it seemed like people liked doing in Deus Ex, and it felt like it did it to such critical acclaim. Like, where does Mankind Divided fit in a world where you already have, you know, something else? I mean, is it just that people are that attached to the aesthetic or to Adam Jensen's, like, love life? Or
you can read a lot of emails in Deus Ex. And that's partly flippant and partly not, which is that the lasting appeal of Deus Ex is that you're in, like, a real place that you're, like, breaking into. I mean, it's a real cyberpunk place, and you're breaking into with your robot arms. But I think maybe the comparison to Wolfenstein holds up there as well. Like, there are civilians in Deus Ex. There's a world around you. Like, the first game famously has that opening where it's like a real place that's only just been taken over by terrorists. So everyone's sort of in disarray, and the whole thing takes place in the real world. But Metal Gear is explicitly like a sandbox where every human being you encounter in that desert is probably a bad guy. And that, I think, changes the feeling of it quite substantially. Like, the bases that you capture and recapture and capture again in Metal Gear are not, like, real offices that you're breaking into. And you're not incentivized to, like, look behind everyone's fridge for the safe where they keep the password to their computer, which where you see the emails from their husband who tells you about the code to the thing under the desk that gets you a candy bar that refills your ability to turn invisible. And that's the Deus Ex loop. Am I selling this to you?
I don't know. I just, you know, people sort of spoke with such sort of glee about what they'd done in Phantom Pain, and that, like, the missions had had legitimately different outcomes, and people had been surprised by things that they were able to do and puzzle solving, I guess. That, you know, like, getting something airlifted out and then realizing you can ride out on top of that thing, you know, kind of stuff. There was a genuine sort of enthusiasm and energy in the game. Felt like it was doing something fresh and new when I was listening to people talking about it. And then with this, people sort of say about, you know, being able to do things in different ways or, like, solve problems in different ways or whatever else. But, you know, I'm not getting the same feeling of being able to be surprised by the game or to sort of be tickled by it or be interested in that way.
I think that the reason there partly is because some of that stuff is quite spoilery. So I could tell you a few ways that a mission could go, but it would be spoilery for me to say that, this character will be here, and actually these are the other ways you can do this. Whereas in Metal Gear, it's such a systems game, and it's so kind of narrative light that you can say, oh, I shot this and these things, this system's interacted to create this entertaining event. Having said all that, like, I would rate Metal Gear Solid higher than Deus Ex. It's a better sandbox game for sure. And I do think that the aesthetic has a lot to do with the reason why Deus Ex, a lot of people will like Deus Ex Mankind Divided.
It's worth maybe also pointing out, like, Dishonored is definitely in the same genre as the Deus Ex. It's far closer to Deus Ex than it is to Metal Gear, in that it's also a game. You know, the other side of it is that maybe prior to Phantom Pain, this comparison would be a bit closer with Metal Gear, but these are also explicitly story games. It's why it's worth dwelling on the story aspect quite so much, is because Metal Gear, Phantom Pain, like, Metal Gear, I mean, you know, obviously the people who love those stories, but they're often impenetrable for new audiences. But you can play that game and have fun even if you have no fucking clue what's going on, or why there's a whale, or any of the stuff, and why the whale's on fire, and where, you know, all that stuff, because it's a systems game, like Tom says. Whereas, you know, the origin of, like, Deus Ex and that kind of immersive sim is actually, it's got a bit of adventure game in its DNA. Like, it's not just shooter plus stealth, or even shooter plus RPG. Like, there's a bit of point-and-click adventure to Deus Ex traditionally. Like, you go and have conversations with people, and you mine out their conversation trees for information that you take places. It's just how you interact with the environment is different. And so, like that, it's about going on an adventure through a story where you have a lot of freedom to kind of direct the course of that story, which Metal Gear isn't. Like, Metal Gear is you have shitloads of freedom during the mission, and then the cutscene plays, and the cutscene is fixed. If that makes sense as a distinction.
Yeah.
Like, this is, like, you know, Deus Ex is, like, and Dishonored is, like, living out this particular adventure that stems in different ways.
I think the world itself is I think your experience has become a more important part of the immersive sim genre since the old Deus Exes, you know.
Mm.
Particularly since Dishonored 1, because just the experience of being in that world and that place was so powerful. And even Bioshock as well, actually, in a different way, because Bioshock is more shootery than immersive sim necessarily.
It's the System Shock branch of family tree.
But for those games, you're in a tighter, more controlled experience, but that experience is more kind of aesthetically powerful. Whereas Metal Gear, you're just in a desert and fun things happen in the desert. It's an interesting to compare the two, though, because Metal Gear Solid 5, Phantom Pain is a stunning game, I think, systemically. I think it deserves to be remembered as a bit of a classic, actually, just for producing an open world game that allows you just so much systemic freedom and letting you just get on with it and really do what you want to. It's really brave, actually.
I think the reason Dishonored stands up so well, and I would argue that it's the best game in the best series, I hope, when the sequel comes out, in that genre, or particularly on the sort of more linear adventure style side, is because, like Metal Gear, it's slightly more of a systems game than the others.
Mm.
And the reason it's slightly more of a systems game, if you sort of conceive its, you know, depth in terms of space, it's like Deus Ex and even something like Hitman get a shitload out of the stealth side of the game. They really invest heavily in that, and there's a lot you can do that's creative. But after a while, people have sort of started to mine out the possibility space of stealth, which is like distract man, hack turret, you know, find vent and all that kind of stuff. And Deus Ex diversifies it, but it's variations on that theme. Deus Ex and Dishonored, the magic powers and stuff help that side a lot, because you get things like possession, which is an interesting idea, and but not massively. Where it gets so much more space is in combat, where it's like, it's basically one of the very few traditional sort of immersive sims that also has genuinely amazing systems driven combat, where every projectile is properly simulated, and you can manipulate the passage of time, and your momentum matters, and all this sort of, all these other things come together, and you maybe see some like lethal, you might see some sort of like lethal skill videos for Deus Ex, but if you ever see skill videos for Deus Ex, it's probably going to be like amazing, stealthy, quick speed runs.
Yeah.
Whereas Dishonored, to an unprecedented degree, I would argue, supports both. Like the best like Dishonored YouTubers will have like amazing stealthy ways of completely speeding through a level. But you see people do the most insane stuff with all of the lethal options that game gives you, which make it look like the greatest sword fighting action game you've ever seen. That have nothing to do with stealth, that are just like being this teleporting ninja assassin man that...
Yeah, seeing people kind of chain take out those tall boys just through just blinking and falling on them and air assassinating them over and over again. And there's an amazing agility to people who are very good at that game.
Yeah.
There's almost another level you can reach that you couldn't reach with the systems of Deus Ex.
That's what I mean. Like the stuff in like Dishonored of like someone... There's videos where... I don't know if I have to put some links in the show notes to demonstrate this, but like people like freezing time, kicking one guy, firing thing, fire a crossbow bolt in the air, and then knowing that a guard will follow him up the stairs, and then like a minute later the crossbow bolt comes back down again, hits the guy in the head, and they know exactly the timing of it. And like, there's nothing stealthy about that. It's not the tricking the guards. It's just manipulating the systems to such a fine degree. Mm. Whereas like firing my upgraded SMG at a man is never going to produce that, simply because the fiction doesn't really permit it in a big way either, to be honest.
Yeah.
And that's why I have really high hopes of Dishonored 2, because it's more powers and more opportunities and more sort of physics-y sort of stuff you can do.
More playgrounds.
Like, just when they, you know, sat there when I saw Dishonored 2 talking to one of the designers, Dinga Bacaba, about, like, just a little thing. Like, Emily has that grapple pull instead of blink, so she grabs a part of the environment and pulls herself towards it.
Hmm.
And the fact that, you know, we were talking about it, and we got around to the fact that that move conserves momentum. Blink doesn't. If you blink point to point, you stop. You just teleport yourself one way to the other. It's actually a very fast dash, but teleporting. Whereas because Emily conserves momentum, that changes. Like if you play it to a certain degree, it's like that doesn't change anything. You're still just moving yourself to a distant place you want to be at. But when you get super into it, the fact that that means you can slide into grab, into leap, into an aerial takedown, it's like, well, that's mind-blowing. That's the biggest thing. And that for me is the healthy sign that a game is substantially, systemically
varied.
And, you know, maybe I should stop there because I'm comparing a game that isn't out to a game I haven't played. But that for me has always been the distinction between Dishonored and any other game that came before Dishonored. But I say that as a man who just can't stop writing retrospectives of Dishonored.
I'm so excited about Dishonored 2. Like, their world building is so good as well. Like, I just love being in their places as well.
I've said all that now, so it better not be shit.
Yeah. Well, we'll see.
Pip.
Hello.
Hello. How have you been getting on with No Man's Sky since we last spoke about it? Because I know you have kept playing it.
It's okay. I went away for a few days, and when I came back, it's feeling very... I don't seem to have been able to recapture the enthusiasm I had for being in one place for a long period of time.
Mm.
Like, I'll stick around if I've seen an interesting animal, or I think that there's an interesting, you know, sort of view to find, or to, you know, some plants that I want to take a closer look at. But it's become more and more that I will go down to a planet's surface, take a quick look. If it's pretty, I'll stick around for a bit, or if there's some weird animal that I want to track down, or a bird or something, then I'll, you know, hang around for a while. But if it's barren, or if it's boring, or if I feel like I've seen it before, I'll just go. And that's a bit... I don't know whether I'll get any mojo back with it, but I do feel really tapped out with it. Like, none of the quests, or such as they are kind of encouraging me to go anywhere else or move forward. And, you know, I feel like I'm hitting a lot of similar enough remixes of the jigsaw puzzles for the procedural generation that it's not exciting to me a lot of the time. That said, this afternoon I did find some fish. Things that actually look legitimately like earth fish. And that was exciting because I hadn't come across any permutations of that yet. But the thing that sort of then got in the way of that was that the behaviour that they were exhibiting, that they were sort of trying to crawl up onto the beach, was the same thing that I'd seen some squid do last week. And so... I mean, even when the jigsaw pieces of the animals are different, the fact that there doesn't seem to be a huge variety in their movement patterns or their behaviour is... It still makes them feel quite samey, or, you know... I still haven't found any animals that are really sort of having any meaningful interactions with each other, you know, chasing each other or... You know, I think... There was one where it looked like they might be, but I think they were just in close proximity. Hmm. And so I'm just finding that I think for me the appeal was always going to be looking at nice colour palettes and being surprised by views or being surprised. But I think the game only supports that to a certain extent. And for some people it will last hours and hours and hours, and for some people it will maybe last 15 minutes or something, but or up until you see a YouTube video of somebody saying, oh, I saw this, and you go, oh, that was really similar to the thing I saw, I thought I was unique, whatever. So I don't really know. I feel maybe that hollowness, I guess, to the experience, or that I'm that to me is coming across as hollowness is perhaps a way of it helps explain why I don't think that it achieves enough that I would pay 40 quid for it, or mm-hmm. why I would be really like I would, if somebody asked whether they should get it, I would probably say, do you want to come over and play it for a bit and see if you want it? Because like, you know, not to do down what Hello Games have done, and these critiques are all heavily caveated with, I have no idea what kind of a time ask anything on that scale would take. You know, I don't know what it would be to ask them to add in a few more movement animations or to make it feel like the animals are actually responding either to each other or to the environment that they've spawned in any meaningful way. But I don't know what that would do in terms of the development cost or timeline, but at the same time, the fact that it isn't there is still a problem for me, because you just sort of start to see all of the joins in the world and it isn't a world anymore. And the world has a lot of pop in anyway, like things sort of dissolve into view right in front of you. And so this is kind of an extension of that almost. It's these constant sort of tap, tap, tap of things that break the illusion just a little bit. And you start to see that it was created by people more so than if you were playing a handcrafted environment that somebody had made to be deliberately immersive and deliberately, literally so in the case of Subnautica, you know, that's so curated and the animals have been designed and animated and, you know, it's a very deliberate place, and yet I find myself able to lose myself far more easily, because the bits all make sense and, you know, there's a deliberate kind of eliding of those joining points, I guess. So, yeah, so I'm sort of not having an amazing time with it, and then the rest of my time has just been spent with clicker games, because
that's... The RPS summer... contest.
Oh god, yeah.
I've enjoyed reading about this, actually. It's been really funny.
What was your favorite event? Did you do any of them?
No, I didn't. I just enjoyed watching you all suffer.
So just to explain for people who might not know, on RPS I decided that we should have a sports day essentially, but it ended up being like a sports couple of days and then kind of a weekend, and we all played things like, there's a particular level in Clock Simulator that only lets you make 5 mistakes when you're trying to click in time to the seconds, and then Devil Daggers, which Alice just, I think
her,
she's actually
crazy. It's like 180 seconds or something.
She's gone further now. She's made
it right the first time, Pip. Just saying.
Thanks.
Before that score was disqualified for some reason.
I think she's actually done her wrist in from like trying to get good at that again. So that was actually really good fun. So Adventure Capitalist was on that list, and so I've been sort of going back to that every like now and again, just because I think it's an interesting clicker game. But on my phone, I've got Abyssarium, which is a clicker game, but about you sort of run a deep sea aquarium, basically. So you can level up things like coral and you can buy more fish, and like there's a little volcano thing that spits out points when you tap on it, or you can, you know, get it to auto tap itself for a certain amount of time, and then there's a recharge time, and you can reset particular bonuses if you want to, but by watching adverts and you know, all of that kind of thing. But I really associate clicker games with being psychologically not healthy, and that's why I've gravitated towards them again at the moment, which is not good. So rather than address any of the underlying issues, which I'm sort of doing on the side, but yeah, I sort of decided to go properly, you know, like when parents, or I don't know, these hypothetical parents that you see on television are just like, oh, well, if you think smoking's so cool and I've caught you smoking one single cigarette, I'm going to make you smoke like 5 packs and then you'll be so ill that you'll never do it again. And so I spent part of this evening in not enjoying, but I had Abyssarium on my phone, I had Adventure Capitalist on one monitor and Cookie Clicker on the other, and I was sort of trying to get to the point of overload with all of them that it felt so pointless and I felt so sickened by myself that I would just stop and I would sort of not feel the urge to, you know, feel rewarded by these Christ. Awful things. Well, not awful. They're actually kind of fun, but, you know, do you know what I mean?
Has it worked?
I mean, I sat there hating myself for a good 10 minutes, but then we're doing the podcast and I'm kind of wondering how my farms are getting on, you know?
Absence so makes the heart click stronger a bit.
Oh. But yeah, so, I mean, I don't think it has worked. And now there's three things that I need to update, which is just, I think this has all gone wrong, to be honest with you.
Yeah, you invented hell. Sounds awful.
Along similar lines, I think I've discovered that I'm an excellent barometer for how quickly the average member of the public will get bored of a mobile game. I genuinely think I'm quite on the money with this, because I got bored of Miitomo, like exactly the same point as everyone else got immediately bored of Miitomo, which was Nintendo's first attempt at mobile games and stuff. And I think I managed to, like, I got really, really bored and passed Pokemon Go after not very long, really. But like, just as I started to think, man, I'm really over that, then I suddenly let the wave of news stories of people being over it in their tens of millions arrived. And I'm not saying I'm a prophet of our digital future, but in some ways, maybe I am.
I see, I don't know how I fit into this, because I was so over both Pokemon Go and Miitomo, like, before anybody else had even had a chance to write their first
paper. This is because you've got taste, Pip.
Well, no, not really, because you, like, because if you talk about mainstream Saturday night BBC television shows, that's my prime, like, I'm the exact barometer for, because, you know, things like Merlin, love Merlin, that's great. And you tried to watch it and you were just like, well, this isn't, like, you know,
this isn't Mallory
at all. You know, and it's just like, well, no, it's not really supposed to be,
is it? Gawain can't be like a fucking wide boy. He can't. He's supposed to be the polite knight. That's his superpower, is he's so polite he'll let a big green man cut his head off.
But it's not real.
Well, no, he'll cut a head off a big green man because green man asks, so I'm getting, yeah,
but it's not real.
Yeah, but it's like superheroes aren't real. This is the problem with Batman. I can't believe I'm getting onto this.
But still, yeah, matters, but so that and things like Holby and things. Do you know what I mean? So yeah, that's my kind of, you know, Tom's is six out of 10 action show
adventure. Oh, yes. Yeah, I'm not immune to this.
So we've all got a niche. We could all be consulting for various.
Maybe this is why you feel a bit, maybe sometimes a bit companies. Lost about Deus Ex, because you know it's an excellent game, but the story is the thing that's a bit naff.
Yeah.
Whereas if I had a really good story, but it was a 6 out of 10 game, you'd probably love it.
Well, actually, maybe what's lacking is that it doesn't have a lightning hammer in it that will make a thing explode.
And it still needs to play Space Marine. I almost bought Space Marine on your recommendation.
It's not amazing, man.
No, I know. And that's why I managed to pull back from the edge, because it's full price on Steam still.
Really?
It's 40
what?
Quid. And you, I was like,
no, it's not. It's worth
it. No, and I was like, no, I'll wait till this is on a Steam sale.
It's going for £3 in a Steam sale. It's fine. It's all good.
Yeah. But nonetheless, I was like, you know, your enthusiasm for it was infectious.
I do enjoy it. Yeah. I'm on Grim Dawn at the moment, which is a very nicely made action RPG in the Diablo 2 kind of mold, but with modern graphics. Got a man now whose shoulder pads are on fire forever. They're magic. And he's got a helmet that's on fire forever. That's also magic. And I just the other day that, like, there's an eye slit in it, and the inside of the helmet is also on fire. So his head's always on fire. And now I can't play that game because I'm like, what am I doing to my little man? And he's just running around. And
you're going to be able to do that in Destiny come the end of September.
Oh, I'm
setting the little man on fire.
I'm really excited about that. Yeah, Destiny.
It's exciting, isn't it? Can't talk about it. It's forbidden, but it's exciting.
No, we could talk about it on a special podcast.
Oh, what a game.
Pods.
Oof. What a good game about making a little man be on fire.
Mm. All the best games.
Can I briefly talk about something I've watched? Because I don't want to talk about anything I've played, because I've only played Dota and Destiny. The Forbidden D's. And there's no Forbidden D for anybody here. So instead, I want to talk about... You're right, Pip. I want to talk about... So, you know, like, I had my Star Citizen adventure and I spoke about it a couple of weeks ago.
Mm.
And so they had their presentation at Gamescom where they showed off, and I watched it today at lunch, which is their hour-long gameplay demo. And I sort of knew a bit of what had happened in it because Sam had talked about it and also had spoken about it, with them prior to the Gamescom about what they were going to be showing. But actually watching it, I'm stuck in this thing with Star Citizen where everyone should watch it because it's kind of amazing. And even if we look back at it in a couple of years, is like when you have that story, which is like, Jesus, do you remember the Gamescom 2016 gameplay demo? Real game looked nothing like that. Whatever. Then it'll still be a really good bit of like sequential reveals of stuff that's like, whoa, no other game is doing that at the moment. But it's like, if that stuff is all just a stage demo, and apparently it's not because it's built out of the demo, the beta that currently exists, and it's just version 3 of the alpha or whatever, then fine, it's all you know, smoke and mirrors. But if they're actually making it, like, that game's actually happening, which is sort of a bit mad to imagine for me, because it's the thing I want more than anything else, which is, like, the free roaming, go anywhere in space, do anything, meet a guy, get a contract, be in Firefly, the game.
Yeah.
But, so the demo it starts off in exactly the same way the alpha does, and the same way my story did about in the podcast, where they sort of get up and out of bed and go and get the ship. But they get a video message from an NPC, and it's not, like, the most amazing acting, but it's quite good mocap. And it's like, you're receiving a video message as if a guy is talking into the computer on his wrist. So it's all quite immersive. And he asks you to come meet him. And then for the sake of the demo, they get in a multi-crew ship and there's another player piloting the ship and they fly off together and they go into hyperspace, which looks amazing. And then they cruise down to the surface of the planet, which looks amazing. And it's all seamless. No loading screens, just straight down. And none of the sort of elite judderiness where it's obviously passing through a kind of grid that it's loading. And they glide down to the surface of the planet. They do sort of an unscripted thing where they land for a bit and get out and struggle to get back in and stuff like that. And then they land on the planet and the base is underground. And I think my game instinct is to look for where the secret loading is happening and where they're buffering new stuff and where you know, I know it's all being streamed in, but where is it really happening, you know? And the ship drops the guy off and the base is underground, so I had like, that's how they're gonna do it.
Yeah,
it'll be just like a rocky topography.
Yeah,
and then the underground zone, which is where the base is, and so they go into the thing, and then there's like, they get out of the ship and the guy and the pilot just takes off and flies off again, and then the guy walks, goes down an airlock, goes down a lift. I'm like, airlocks and lifts, these are definite, this is where the mirror is, right? This is where it's passing into the secret interior zone. And he comes out in the lobby of this base on this planet, and there's a statue, and the statue's in front of this massive window. And Chris Roberts, in his sort of salesman-y way, goes like, oh, just look out the window. And then the ship comes down outside. And so they're still in the exterior cell, which is fucking nuts. Because they're looking out the window and the ship is there. And you can see through the cockpit window to the pilot. And then they can cut to the pilot, and the pilot can see through the window into the base and see the guy wave from inside the base. Then gets in another lift, and the pilot goes with him, like down in the lift, because the lift is on the exterior of the base.
Oh no!
And so it's not a fucking loading lift. It's not a loading lift.
Yeah.
It's an actual lift. And they made a point of this, and you know, there's nothing more Gamescom than the entire like audience for Star Citizen just bellowing for a lift. Like, it's a real lift. It's not a button that triggers a loading screen.
Yeah,
it's an actual fucking lift they're amazed about in space. And so that's all very impressive. And they go to this like underground market that looks like a zone out of Borderlands or something, and it looks really detailed and amazing. They meet an NPC, and the NPC goes, go and get me this black box recorder from this ship that's been destroyed. And I say this, and I'm doing a concerned expression, because I'm genuinely concerned that this is real. Because if it is real, then I'm excited. But I don't want to be excited, because I don't want to be disappointed. And they go off, and like, yeah, there's like, and I was sort of ready for all of this to just be the normal video game stuff. As they go off, and they find the wreck, but it's pirates nearby, and they're in a dogfight, and the guy in the tail gun is fighting, and they fight, and they destroy the pirates, and that's cool. And then it's like, we need to go and get the black box. It's like a big cargo ship. It's one of the ones the players can own, but it's like been destroyed and split in half. And so like, drop him off. And so they swing by, they spin the ship around, and open the back door of the ship, and the guy just gets out and does an EVA over to the ship that they're getting the black box from. They don't target it and then like do scan, and then the scan pulls the data across automatically. I'm like, the fuck is this? And it's a lot like the very first episode of Firefly, where you see them kind of like picking through the... Then he flies around to the gap in the ship, gets inside the ship, pulls out a gun, starts exploring, shoots a pirate that's on board. And there's all this detail and like frozen bodies and stuff like that. Then goes up to the captain's quarters and downloads the manifest, and then goes down to the cargo bay, finds a space motorbike, then drives it out of the cargo hold, into the cargo hold of his ship, and then they fly down to a planet, and then there's like fires the land speeder at the back of the ship, and then there's like a ground combat bit between vehicles.
Wow.
And like, it is legit, like, I'm either going to, in a couple of months, weeks, years time, when this is all known, I'm either going to look like the most naive man alive, or they've genuinely made that game and everyone is wanting them to make. There's even a bit towards the end where, this is the thing that seems very stagey, and I don't buy that the game will actually be like this. Some of the pirates turn out to be players, and so there's like a PvP bit at the end, and I don't know how the fuck that would ever work, but fine, put Dark Souls Invasions in it if you want.
Yeah.
Make the perfect game. And at the end, it's like in a a firefight with this one guy in this sort of like moon exterior base, and they're in space suits, but they're all like fighting around crates and stuff. And he runs out of ammo, and then you just hear this kind of like thundering, kind of like boom, 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 and these two shells hit the guy, and he like spirals off into space, and he's dead. The other player, and then the guy looks around, and the ship that they've been done this whole thing, the transport ship, is just sort of hovering outside the base with its cannons pointing down, which is again basically a Firefly beat. Minus the cannons, like that whole like, and then the ship bailed you out kind of moment.
Yeah, yeah.
And I don't mean to just like, I would, probably the first time in the podcast I've ever just recounted the entire story of a piece of marketing.
Yeah.
But I did watch it going, expecting to see planetary landings, talking to NPCs and doing a mission. But the whole thing was so much more impressive than that, that it's actually a little bit unsettling, because there's something about that project, having seen it up close and knowing some of the people involved and liking some of the people involved, I still have that little thing of like, this can't possibly be real, can it? They can't make every game.
The promise is so great that, I mean, I feel like I still can't believe it, even though I've seen that demo as well and it's hugely impressive. But we've seen impressive demos before, albeit not an hour long. I mean, it was a proper kind of...
And it's obviously not...
live. It was dicking around live, and they showed the computers, and they were controlling different computers and stuff. So, like, a lot of the Smoke and Mirrors, standard Smoke and Mirrors stuff wasn't happening. But it's, at the same time, it's like, will it really be this way? In which case, I mean, if it is, great. That'd be fucking amazing.
On YouTube, at least, the comparisons with No Man's Sky are completely fucking tiresome, because they're different games telling you to do very different things. The only area where you can make an interesting comparison between those two things is in terms of the marketing of the games, because the question of what you do in Star Citizen isn't really in any doubt. And they're showing it, right? This is what you do in Star Citizen. You get a mission, you go and have a space fight, you do a ground fight, you do a spacey ground fight, ride a bike. It's cool. And the question is whether this completely unstaged looking marketing material can ever actually become a real thing. Whereas with No Man's Sky, it was like, what does this very staged
marketing mean?
Trailer translate into?
True.
And they're very different things. And it's interesting how, in a way, or maybe it's a bit easier to trust the promise of a beautiful 3-minute trailer, because you know exactly to what extent it's a lie, pretty much. Because, you know, it's not going to have beautifully soundtracked music and perfect editing.
Yeah.
Watching an unedited thing where it's like actually so impressive is almost harder, because you're like, come on, pull the other one. What is the shoe that is waiting to drop?
Yeah.
Like, what is it about this that isn't good? Because, like, right, like, that should be my most anticipated game, and it still isn't. And it's just that drive of like, can't trust it. Need it to arrive fully formed. And
yeah, there's still the luxury of time to kind of see these alphas roll out bit by bit, and you know, there's no pressure on anyone to invest until it has become that game, which is nice. It's not like people have kind of necessarily pre-ordered in the same way that they did with No Man's Sky.
They have spent tens of thousands of dollars on spaceships.
Yeah, but I mean, they paid that knowing that all they'd be able to do with it for a long time would be to look at it and get inside it. Like, I think they're probably quite clear about what you got from it.
Yeah, maybe. I think they have been.
Relatively. I mean, obviously, I mean, it's a huge amount of money to spend on that, but if people think that's valuable to them, then...
Oh, for sure, I'm not...
Yeah,
not,
of course, yeah.
I'm really not in a position to judge that sort of thing, but it's still...
I don't think they've necessarily been missold. I mean, if that game never materialises, will a lot of those people feel like they've been, you know...
I think they would, but...
I think you're right.
I would. But, yeah, no, I mean, I don't really have much more to say about that.
It's just, it's interesting.
It interesting makes me aware of how cynical I've become, I think, because it's like, I think a younger version of me that was more idealistic about how game development worked and didn't know as much about how game development works would be like, that would be my fucking Twitter avatar and my fucking Twitter banner, and it'd be all I was thinking about.
But why does it have to be cynicism? Why isn't it realism?
It is realism to an extent, but it's that thing of like, realistically, I would not have expected for them to show so much successfully. That's the thing. And so having your realistic expectations exceeded is a sort of a new thing in a way. Not seeing the lines, the draw.
I guess. I think I just, until I touch it, I don't believe it.
Mm. No,
You know, like everything that anyone shows me is to try and get me to buy into it. So
yeah, and I think it helps in this case that I have touched part of it. Like they're expanding an alpha that I've already played. So I know big parts of it are real. So therefore it's easier to extrapolate to the things that they're showing that are bolted on. But God knows how it's going to flesh out. And like, God knows how you can create like a galaxy of planets at that level of detail or anything like that. That still seems like there isn't enough money in the universe to pay for that. But maybe I'll be wrong. Don't know. Shall we do questions from questions?
Yeah.
PC Gamer contributor Jody McGregor writes, "Dear Kroot and Chainsword, regarding where Zinch got its name, there's an interview with game designer and former Games Workshop managing director Brian Ansel, in which he explains the origins of the four main Chaos Gods. Zinch, he says, was meant to be the sound of a spell blasting out, like in a Doctor Strange comic. It also has a sort of Aztec feel, which goes with the feathers and the bright pastel colours." There you go.
Yeah.
Fans of questions we asked in previous podcasts.
Mm.
He goes on, he says, Jody also says that he mentions Nurgle being named after a Babylonian god, which we covered last time. But amusingly, it was also a recurring nonsense word that the comedians of the Goon Show used in phrases like "great walloping scraps of Nurgle" and "flap me Nurglers," which is a good summation of Games Workshop's tonal range in general. Actually. Yeah, it's like anywhere from like Babylonian mythology to the Goon Show, the Goons.
That explains a lot of the sense of humor around Nurgle, actually, because it's a lot of that is quite slapstick and weird. Interesting.
His question, which I think is interesting, is, do you have a preference for made-up names being evocative combinations of real words, like putrid stump, or onomatopoeic things that resonate, like Karak Ungor? Both are real Warhammer places.
I'm aware, sadly.
Thanks for talking, everybody. Professional Warhammer nerd, Jody. And Jody genuinely is a professional Warhammer nerd. I'll put his explanation of why Space Marines are awesome.
Yeah,
he wrote for us on the in the show notes because it's genuinely awesome.
Yeah, Space Marines are crazy.
I am a fan of evocative combinations of real words.
I much prefer that as well because I just instantly forget nonsense words.
See, I don't, which might be the problem. Like my brain is full of fucking Orgrimmar and Orzammar and the difference between those two things, and like. I don't need that, really. Whereas I much prefer, like, poetic or evocative phrases, particularly when they don't necessarily, like, fully gel with the thing they're describing. I like that's, like, disconnect. So, putrid stump might be a bit literal for me.
Although you're a fan of Bungie, and they seem to be very good at this particular thing.
Yeah, they really, 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 really are. Yeah. Like, it's one of the reasons I love Destiny's fiction so much, is there's very little... I mean, actually, no, Destiny is full of... I mean, there's even a quest in The Taken King that has a bit of a pop at the names for stuff in Destiny. It has a lot of, like, Ugor, the Burninator, and stuff like that. But particularly in the item names, there's loads of really interesting, like, half-phrases. Like, the thing I was going to mention is it's heavily inspired by the Culture novels.
Oh, yeah.
Which, like, where ships name themselves after, you know... thousand of years old English idioms and stuff like that. So yeah, like if the culture was real, there'd definitely be a culture ship called Thanks for Listening, Everybody. There just would.
Yes, for sure.
I always like that sort of thing. Any other preferences?
I think it just depends on the person. I mean, I find Tolkien insufferable. But at the same time, he is very good at the shape of the word in your mouth conveying something of the people that he's talking about, like the orcs, or you know, the places that are named for particular sort of or by particular races. I think that there's a lot of sort of onomatopoeic, but also just sort of his grasp of linguistics is so obvious through, you know, the way that he has actually even just sort of come up with actual alphabets for all of this, and you know, all kind of the lexicography, and stuff that I do find really irritating a lot of the time, but when you encounter it in passing, it does actually manage to be evocative in really sort of useful and beautiful ways sometimes. But then I also really like how things like Fallen London and Sunless Sea play with language. And some of that is, you know, not exactly, it's not made up, but it's unusual combinations of words. Like, you know, all of their, not all of them, but like a lot of their communiques to you will start off, you know, delicious friends and things like that, that are just sort of gloriously, you know, slightly skewed uses of language or kind of interesting.
They've gotten such a lot of mileage out of the adjective noun format for people.
Oh, yeah.
Like, yeah. The coquettish octopus.
and you, it starts to sort of, not exactly grate sometimes, but, you know, you become very aware of it being one of the things that they do. But at the same time, they do it to such wonderful effect. And it's sort of, I think anything that feels like someone is reveling in language and has a real sort of sense of what they want to do. But when it's just somebody who's like run their finger across the keyboard and gone, right, that can be the deity's name. You're just a bit like, oh, for goodness sake, you haven't really, you're phoning this one in really, aren't you? Or,
the big issue I have with that is a former linguist is that it often creates, they like write a linguistic check for the game that they can't cash to really butcher the English language, which is you end up with, like, because, you know, words are always usually derivatives of other words and other languages and other sort of coinages and stuff. So if you have a cast of characters who speak English but whose god is called, you know, Belaramador, the Sun Lord, then they've basically said that there's another language that Belaramador comes from that they've, you know, they don't really necessarily back up. Whereas actually, you know, you either have names that are fairly common in that names, or it's words that are interchangeable with other words that mean multiple things that are part of the same language that people are speaking. So honestly, I'd prefer in that scenario that the god be called Sun Lord, because that actually makes more sense and is linguistically a little bit sounder.
Yeah, I can't stand just fantasy whiffle, where people just replace words that already exist in the English language with a different word just to prove that it's in a different universe. And it's like, I know that this is in the fantasy universe. Yeah, I don't need to hear the word bizzle for steak. In this world, they call steak bizzle. So it's, you know,
selective use of new words in English among English-speaking characters is like the worst thing, particularly when those characters... Well, particularly in English, we have a word for that thing.
Exactly, yeah.
What really used to bother me, actually, about Farscape was Frel, because that felt so wrong. Like, it was, I think it was their version of fuck, basically. It was like, you know, that, and it was something that you could say on TV, and it was something that you could, you know, sort of get away with, and also made the universe kind of, like, slightly foreign or whatever. But it was like, it just didn't have the same satisfying, like, clunk that fuck does, that good old sort of Anglo-Saxon, like, shouting.
Frack in Battlestar has the same problem.
It's Smeg in Red Dwarf.
It is self-censorship for TV, which is part of it, but it is sort of a weird, yeah,
but
I agree.
Still, you're just like, come up with something that sounds a bit more like you would say it in a moment of anger, you know?
Yeah.
Something that has a T in it or a K, you know?
It's interesting how that works, actually, because, like, when you look at the Krogan and the Klingon, these sounds repeat through a lot of different fiction to evoke the same type of race, almost, the same type of warrior archetypes. And personally, I find that quite helpful because it really does characterise that race for me quickly in the Asari, who are the more elven kind of, you know, the softer consonants and stuff. So I like it when it's done well and it's not like 10 syllables long, which a lot of just arbitrary fantasy phrases are.
It should be a little hammer that swings down and like knocks you on the head if you use like an apostrophe, like an interstitial apostrophe in fantasy.
Yeah, they should.
Tolkien was a big fan of, you know, circumflexes and so forth.
Yeah. He sort of knew what he was doing, though.
I know. That's the thing where I'm sort of a bit annoyed about this, because I'm kind of... My irritation with him is so all-encompassing that I desperately want to be annoyed about the thing that I genuinely like that he does. Mm. And it's like, I'm just like, oh, even the fact that the circumflexes are there is really, it's brilliant and it's internally consistent and it really builds into this idea of a world that's genuinely inhabited and has been for thousands of years. But because it's him, I just want to smack him with them.
It's because he goes on and on about it.
It is the most well-substantiated whiffle in the history of whiffle.
Yeah.
But there's still something quite pretty about, so like Galadriel and Elrond and the way that those words come out of...
I really like stuff like Barad-dûr. Mm. Like, yeah. That is just such a...
Makes you want to roll your R's all the time. It's a good feeling.
These are delicious words, you know. He does have a passion for the sound of language. It's almost perfect.
So basically, we like it when it's done well and not when it's a load of tosh.
Yeah, it's just when it's uncritical. It's the same thing with, like... You know, we were in a discussion about this, maybe we're dwelling too long on this one question, but we had an interesting discussion the other day about, in the office, I think, or maybe even in the pub, about distinctions between, like, the stuff like those are Wizard of the Coast games and Dungeons and Dragons and, like, that setting and Games Workshop stuff, actually. That sort of interesting 80s distinction between fantasy derived from Tolkien in the US and often on the West Coast of the US and fantasy derived from Tolkien in Britain that was also going through the era of 2000 AD comics and stuff.
Mm.
And I think Jody actually had made the same comparison. And it's sort of interesting. You have one that's sort of quite sort of bright and optimistic and very modern feeling in some ways in Dungeons and Dragons in terms of the politics of the world and how people relate to one another.
Yeah, or just fundamentally heroes conquering evil. You know, that basic moral imperative.
It's a clean medieval world.
Yeah.
It's not riddled with... You know,
it's not Judge Dredd, is it? It's not,
like,
yeah,
but it's not Nurgle either, which is the other thing, which is like, you know, if in the Warhammer Fantasy setting, Nurgle is this basically like sometimes funny, sometimes horrifying version of medieval grossness writ on a huge scale.
Yeah, and the whole thing of Nurgle as well is that it's life as much as the pretty elves are life, and the idea that disease is life is, and why is that less valid than this other particular type of life is again, that's the classic Warhammer thing of Shades of Grey. Yeah. I'm not going to really get into why Warhammer is amazing fiction or anything, but there is a definite difference in
philosophy
behind it, certainly. Yeah,
which is not to make it like it's not about sort of nationality in any way. It's just about different cultures at different times drawing from the same source material.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it?
Anyway, that's almost entirely on a different set of topics to the
question
to the podcast.
Thanks for the question, Jody.
Yeah, it was a good question.
Yeah, good one.
Happily natter about that. Who's this? I forgot to put their name in the thing. I fucked it up. Let me click a thing and then click another thing.
Mr. Elrond Bizzle of
there you go.
The Land of Amelot.
Pierce Shea writes, I saved it, no one noticed. Dear Crimson Crumpets, no question, and as an American, Holby has me totally lost, but I would love a Towie Telltale game. Joey Essex will never remember this. I think my partner would love a Great British Bake Off a la Valhalla, or whatever it's called, where you make food and then have visual novel discussions with the entirely adorable Ian. Thanks. Pierce. Pip, you approve of this one, I think.
I do. They might be interested to know that I think Graham a while ago sent emails to a bunch of developers to just get them to send in a hypothetical pitch for a Great British Bake Off game. So that might be worth going back and reading. I've completely forgotten the specifics of the submissions, but I think that Robert Yang was one of the people who came up with a thing. So.
Hmm.
Yeah, I should probably go back and dig into that, put the link in the show notes. But this goes back to my point last week about I think that there are these whole swathes of entertainment and pop culture that get sidelined because they're not really the things that are enjoyed by the people who are predominantly making games. Or, you know, they get put into... the formats of casual games on phones, like the Kim Kardashian Hollywood game. But yeah, like, I just really want somebody to work out how to create a soap opera as a game, and not in a kind of like, oh, we're all in the middle of the fucking glade and here's a toasting fork and let's go deal with some elves or I don't know, whatever nonsense you have in games nowadays. But, you know, I want something that actually feels true to, you know, like a local doctor practice or, you know, like one of those things that you would find on daytime TV, like regional daytime TV maybe even. You know, like
you have to create intentionally slightly duff sets as well to just really sell the aesthetic of it. It sounds like a good challenge.
What's the one with Martin Clunes, you know?
Oh.
The doctor thing.
Not Pie in the Sky.
No, Doc Martin.
Yeah.
Like, stuff like that. Like, stuff with, like, a kind of gentle storyline and... Or, like, The Archers or something, you know, I'm
probably... We keep returning to the fact that, you know, everyone's gone to The Rapture is such a missed opportunity to make... The Archers, the game.
Yeah.
Because it basically is the Archers apocalypse, which I think is the way we put it in the podcast originally.
Mm. But yeah, but I like this person's, you know, idea. Although, I was reading, I think Slate did something about, like, why the Great British Bake Off is so amazing, you know, blah, 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 blah. But in America, they call it the Great British Baking Show or something.
God damn it.
And it's like, no! Surely, that like, feels like it somehow America fundamentally knows. I thought America, like,
invented the dance-off, which is we're getting at.
I'm guessing maybe there's, like, an issue with, like, trademark or something. I don't know.
Mm.
But, yeah, and that just... I don't know. I got weirdly angry about that one. It was one of the things I wasn't expecting to get angry about. But also, like, I think the acronym is really important on Twitter. Like, going back to the previous question about, you know, the way words kind of feel... Hmm. But, like, Gabibo is, like, that's a thing that I look at and I feel fond and the rounded letters are actually part of that at this point. They've kind of become imbued with a kind of, like, Gubbo. Lovely rounded fondness almost.
Great British Baking Outrage,
you should call it. But, yeah, so I don't know. I'd like that. In summary, yes. I think. Maybe.
Next question is from Andrew and his daughter Aurora.
Aww.
Very pretty name. Dear Secret Pipcast. First, I wanted to say how much I enjoyed the aforementioned secret show. I don't know if it was increased confidence, preparation, or levels of whimsy.
Oh, God.
A word I know Pip loves. But Pip was exceptionally eloquent and highly humorous throughout. So congratulations, Pip.
Yay! Oh, thank you.
My actual question regards No Man's Sky and my 3-year-old daughter. I've been trying to find a game for her to play for a while now, since she enjoys the idea of playing games, but can't do anything beyond vaguely pushing sticks around and roughly pressing X on demand. And this led me to low-threat exploration games with simple movement, which led me to No Man's Sky, space being a particular draw for her. Do you think this would work for her? Would I be able to put her on a planet and have her wander about, or would she be killed and get stuck on scenery? Would I be able to put her in space and have her drift around looking at planets, or would she crash and blow up? I know there are survival mechanics and you won't last that long without refueling things, but as long as you can go 15 minutes without problems, then that's fine. Plus, and restarting from fixed save points is actually a plus, since nothing will be lost. Also, do you have any better ideas for her? I thought about Firewatch, but I wasn't sure how much it would have for someone unable to search for points of interest. Thanks for your help, Andrew and Aurora.
I definitely wouldn't recommend No Man's Sky. I think there's just too much going on, and I can't imagine my niece, who is pretty much the same age as Aurora, kind of getting to grips with it before deciding that Peppa Pig or something was far more, or Topsy and Tim it is at the moment, was far more the flavour of the moment. I'd say maybe something like Abzu would be worth trying, simply because it's so gentle and you aren't sort of ever in danger. There are moments you might want to play through it first, because I have no idea whether Aurora's okay with sort of mild threat. I know that, you know, like, I've known 3-year-olds who are like, you know, pretty hard, actually. And I've known three-year-olds who will absolutely freak out if you even sort of, you know, stand them next to something vaguely threatening. So I think there are maybe some moments that she might find unsettling, but I think on the whole, it's like, you know, you get to look around at fish and you can, you know, you can put her in the meditation bit where you just move the stick and it follows a new fish around for a while. So, you know, things like that might be more kind of geared towards you both having a better experience than, you know, getting frustrated with needing to do a bit too much and her getting frustrated with, you know, you swooping in and needing to take the controls.
Yeah. No Man's Sky is really busy with dangers and things you need to fiddle with and maintain and refill and so on.
And also some of the monsters can actually be a bit scary, I'd say. Like the things that just come up behind you and, like, I had a crab that just wouldn't leave me alone and was, like, properly, like, trying to eat me. But there's also just, like, unsettling looking creatures that have, you know, like a weird sphincter neck and a flower growing out of it instead of a face. And so I can imagine that, I mean, I just think they're weird or funny or whatever, but I can imagine that maybe if you were a little kid, you'd be kind of unsettled by that.
I'm trying to think of just really fun physics games like Katamari Damacy, where you just, like in that game, you just roll around and pick stuff up. And if I was three, I would think that was hilarious. And there's no real threat to it. It's just funny to watch your giant ball of stuff get bigger. I'm trying to think of like equivalents of that on PC.
There's, I think, Digital Bird Playground, because that was at the Wild Rumpus when we were at GDC. And you're just a pigeon on a little bike, like that can ding its bell and run around a little playground space and throw the ball into a net and things. I have absolutely no idea if it's out yet or if it's actually going to get released. I know that there's just this build that floats around expos and stuff. So that might be worth having a look to see if there's anything that's in a playable form.
That's not like good ideas, especially if we're still talking about the exploration remit. We talk about games for kids quite a lot.
Yeah.
The exploration remit's an interesting one. Patrick writes, what are the most painfully middle-class games? How would you make one for design-wise?
Surely anything that costs like 40-something quid and needs a Vive.
that's more explicitly economics derived.
Yeah.
You know, there's a cultural aspect to this as well. You know what, I was thinking about this, because I think their answer is, I think Civ might be the most middle-class game ever derived, because it is sort of about, it's about sort of like having loads of power, but with like all the edges sanded off, because it's human history, but nothing really bad ever happens, or if it does happen, it happens as an extreme abstract, like, you know what I mean? Like, it's like the history of human life, but without...
It's like
out of the dirt.
It's like if history was just a comfortable potted garden that you tended to, over the period of 100 turns, Civ.
Yeah. And also the sort of structure of it is sort of, you know, you're sort of luxuriating in this sort of hobby version of human life where you, it's the grow your own vegetable patch
of humanity control.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly what I mean.
I can get that. I grab that. Yeah, it's interesting, like, the concept of middle class is so different from culture to culture anyway. But, like, everybody's gone to the Rapture, it feels like just a nice middle class jaunt through post-apocalypse, and there's a nice pub, and then you sit there for a bit, and there is no people there because they're all dead, but apart from that, you know, otherwise, it's a nice...
It is actually, yeah, it is very middle class, because it's sort of, it is about, like, quite urbane... scientists bringing about a very middle-class apocalypse. Whereas, you know, it is very much like, well, you know, I may have fallen out with my husband, but I have also attracted the attention of the light from space that eats people.
But it's also in the trappings of that. So, you know, the greenhouses and the radios and the kitchens and
picket
the
fences and
furnishings and things like that. So... And that's a slightly weird thing, because I guess, you know, I went with the economically middle class just because I think that that middle class, as I understand it, tends not to be represented in games because a lot of games are sort of American centric.
Yeah.
Or they're sort of interested in the other worlds to express a point of view, so cyberpunk or fantasy or, you know, whatever else. And so I guess a lot of the things that I associate with, I guess, that white Southeast English middle class upbringing, like, you know, like passive aggressive dinner parties or, you know, things like that, or, you know, sandwiches or church fates or things like that, you know, it's they tend not to crop up in games in
I think, yeah, I think it was sensible. I mean, you're right that it is the trappings of everyone's got to the rapture that make it that. It is, you know, Reginald hasn't returned my lawnmower. Well, he did turn into light and vanish, Deirdre. but actually, I do think that that American sense of middle classness is represented Civ 1, The Sims is another, which is explicitly a simulation of very middle class American life. Like, it's the, you know, that is a game, a simulation of life that is incapable of rendering life outside of a very specific suburban American idea of what living means, where people have massive houses and massive gardens. That's a game that can't even really do British middle class, because British middle class is, there's some, you know, living, you're either out in the countryside to some degree, you're out in a village, or you are in, you know, an amazing three-story terrace house somewhere in North London with a, you know, a pokey garden, but, you know, a car parking space.
Yeah, so the middle class dream of what the middle class American sort of rendition of, you know, having your plot of land and building your dream house and it being like this amazing huge thing is that version. And the British version of a middle class Sims thing would be arguing with your neighbours for planning permission and sort of you've listed building, you're not allowed to do a particular thing to it, and then you fall out with the neighbors anyway, and then you have a sort of weird standoff relationship where, you know, if you see them in the garden, then you can't go in the garden.
It'd lead to that Midsummer Murders game you want, because it would be like, well, they built a conservatory without planning permission, so you killed them and buried them under your own illegal conservatory.
It's got to be a cheese shop, in the artisanal cheese shop, and someone joins a wine club and does some wine tasting.
Oh, there's usually a book group.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Book group.
Good old book group.
Murderous book groups. It's a staple of the British middle class.
Mm.
If we were going to craft a perfect middle class game, then it'd probably just look a lot like Bath, wouldn't it? And, you know.
Yeah.
World of Bath.
Meets Bath.
It would be, yeah. Tell you what, it would be about, I wonder if you make a game out of, like, that particular form of gentrification that's hit Bath. Because there is, you know, the much more problematic gentrification of like major cities where it's, you know, poor and underprivileged people getting kicked out of areas they've lived in for generations in favor of places. Yeah. You know, that's a very international phenomena. But I've definitely spotted Bath has been middle class for far longer than that particular concept of gentrification has existed, but it has happened.
Yeah.
Like, it'd be interesting to see, like, okay, take this grotty pub. How do you, and then rebrand it as a gastropub, the game.
Or fend off the offers.
Yeah, exactly.
Try
and
stay.
That'd be a better game. It would be a very middle class game, but the middle class would be the source of the horror.
Yeah. Mm. So, for example, like a lot of ex-PC gamer writers might have hung out in, what was the bar next to Moles? It was called
Porter.
The Porter. And that's been turned into a expensive.
That was the worst story I've ever seen. This is totally off topic, but like there was a story in the local paper like a day later, which was like, what a budding entrepreneur. And it was about this guy who'd been walking down the street and gone, that pub's in a great place in the center of town. How dare that be a grotty student drinking place for 20 something journalists to go to?
Yeah.
And so he bought it on the spot and turned it into a gastropub. It
died that day,
and it literally died. Another part of Bath's soul was gone.
So there's a place which is basically made of blood and lies, where they sell bee sting, and the walls in the kind of cellar are covered in black bin bags because I don't know why.
It's always Halloween.
And
that's remaining places for us to drink.
It's the last bastion.
I wonder how you make a game out of that. Like, because when I moved to, when we started living in Bath, I guess like 5 years ago, there were at least
There were a handful of those.
There were more than five pubs of that stripe, and now I could name three that I would go to semi-regularly. Maybe four. But not in central town.
Yeah.
And but I'd have no idea how you make a game out of the dwindling supply of actual pubs for humans.
Yeah.
I was thinking that there would be maybe a survival game, but themed around PTA meetings, you know, parish council things, or for America, it would be maybe the Homeowners Association or Neighborhood Watch or something, and just sort of having to get through the situation, choosing which things to care about, or, you know, which people you're going to ally with, and whether it's going to come back to bite you when you need to apply for planning permission for your thing next week, or, you know, those kinds of things. That might be
petty arguments, the game.
Yeah, basically. Petty
local wranglings.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I worry that I failed to spin a game out of my idea so much as just identify a problem.
We can workshop it, though. We can make this the thing.
Shit there. Pub tycoon. Well, yeah, lovably shit pub tycoon.
There was actually thing quite recently. I can't remember the developer, but it was about essentially gentrification economics. And so you would click on blobs to buy and sell them. And so you'd buy a building, and then if it was in a desirable area, then it would start to increase in height, and then the trick was to sell it before, you know, it popped and went back down to zero, and so you were trying to increase your capital. And then but it also did have these weird quirky buildings that would crop up, and they were little communities that would spring up from like in London, how gentrification works essentially, because this is what it was, you know, replicating in a basic way, that a community of, you know, artists or students or, you know, anybody who, or people who were living in a place that you could just about afford to, in the case of London. And then suddenly everyone would be like, oh, well, that looks actually quite nice now. Let's sanitize it, and let's, you know, put in some coffee shops and some, you know, facilities and, you know, all of this kind of thing. And then the property prices would skyrocket. But essentially it was just sort of all modeled in this sort of 3D, you know, buildings going up and down kind of a way, and you'd just be, you know, playing with it while it told you about the processes and stuff. And so it was pretty didactic and pretty, you know, one note, but, you know, it was also an interesting just model to play with.
It's interesting. British artist Grayson Perry did a great series of Wreath Lectures into 2014, where he describes how artists basically are the vanguard for gentrified areas, and how they actually make an area cool and then people move into it. So some sort of RTS where you're sending artists into areas.
RTS. RT strategy.
Oh my God.
We've done it. We've solved it.
Nice. RTS.
We won the question.
Finally.
Oh, it's amazing though, because the Evening Standard has been trying to make Deptford happen in the same way as you know, Gretchen's trying to make Fetch happen in...
I use that mean analogy far too often to describe everything.
Very, very long time. And it's always oh, Deptford's up and coming. It's mate, it's been at least 10 years that you've been saying this. Just shut up.
Our final question, providing that we are done on the topic of the middle class.
Well, I mean, I've always got things to say about the middle class. But, I mean...
Our final question is from Revolver Rossalot, who writes, he references one of Pip's tweets where she describes having to write news through the medium of expressive dance. He says, given the below tweet, what would each of the podders trigger with a /dance command in real life, referring to the little command you can type in almost any MMO to make your character do a boogie? What would yours be, Pip?
I attended a wonderful wedding this weekend, but had that thing where I wasn't really drinking towards the end. So we did the toasts and things. I was drinking for that. But then for the evening, I was mostly just on soft drinks. And so At some point, I became aware that I dance like an uncle now. An uncle at a wedding. And I was so horrified, I didn't know what to do or how to reset. So I did a weird doggy paddle out of the room and tried to leave. But, like, while sort of almost clawing at the air to, like, get my way through my shame. And then a friend of mine saw me doing that and then started doing it as well. And then another friend. And then so there were three of us doing this. And it was just... And I don't think that made it cool. I think that made it worse.
So I think... So your / dance command would trigger, like, a zone-wide existential crisis.
I think... Yeah, well, I think it might just trigger me to be booted from the server. Like... Unless there's anything you actually associate with me. Probably just falling over or something.
Well, you mentioned it earlier, but I was going to say the Carlton.
Oh, yeah. That was a great day when Destiny added that one.
I was going to say that, so Destiny had a lot of very, very good dance emotes. I hate to return to the Forbidden D one last time, but...
You don't.
I love it. But they added the Apache dance. You know, the kind of dun, 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 jump on it, and so on. And I fucking love that dance.
Did we ever establish whether this was a sex thing?
What? Jump on it?
Yeah.
Like all pop music and dancing, Pip, it is.
Okay. Okay.
But no, I fucking love that dance. Partly because it's a perfect balance of silly, obviously, but it's not like all in silly like the Carlton dance is. It's got like range. It's got the silly twirly bit, which is silly, but it's also got the kind of four part hip popping section.
Oh, because that's really serious.
It's not that it's serious. It's that it's a sassier form of silly than the exuberant silliness of the spinny bit. You should have expected me to have an opinion about this, Pip. So don't give me that look. And so what that allows you to do, when you trigger the emote in Destiny, you go into the kind of dun, 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 dun.
You know dun, that people dun, can dun, only dun. Hear you going, yeah, duh.
They can imagine it, though. And I envy them that they imagine it, because it's much better than the reality, what they're imagining. And that bit is incredibly useful as a dance emote goes, because it can be, you control somebody with it. It can also express a sort of like defiant self-belief in the face of the thing you've just done wrong and so on. And then the silliness at the end, the sort of like, you know, the kind of cowboy rodeo twirl thing. This song might well be extremely racist.
Well, this is the thing, because I'd never heard of it before. And then you were like, I'm just dancing to Apache. And I'm like, are you committing a hate crime? Like, what is this?
It was a different era, Pip. 2000 and whatever the fuck that was. But the point is, ultimately, at the end of the day, that's a great dance, and I enjoy it very much. Tom?
Just some sort of incredibly lazy variant on the worm.
Just lying down.
That's right, where you just kind of, you get halfway through it, in the kind of, that kind of coil where, but before you spring up, you just be completely stationary on the floor, face down. That's the emote I want in every MMO, where I just look like a toddler, just lying on the floor, just completely still.
Oh,
like a form of protest.
Has anyone put a moonwalk in a game?
Oh, must have done.
George. There is one in Destiny, I think. I think it's part... I might be wrong about this. I think it's part of the Thriller dance. I think they did a little Michael Jackson medley thing.
Oh, okay. Cool.
I think there's one in WoW as well. There's a character in WoW that moonwalks, I think. Yes, it's the Night Elf male. Why the fuck do I remember that? I used to be really into dance emotes.
Nerd!
Is it nerdy or is it cool and sexy? It's nerdy. That's all the questions we've got time for.
Okay. Oh, sorry, yeah. That wasn't supposed to have an answer.
Better be okay with
that
Pip.
A bulletin for Pip.
And for all of our listeners. Who should also know that if they'd like to send us a question, they can tweet us at Creighton Crowbar. They can email us at questions@questioncreightonshit.
Question Creighton shit.
Question Creighton shit.
Just email that and see what happens.
Yeah.
It's not going to work, is it? They can email us at... Why is this hard? Don't email that. That's a different account entirely. That's a question for your GP. You can email us questions@creightoncrowbar.com. You can leave a question on the forum, creightoncrowbar.com/forum. If you'd like to discuss the episode, you can do so on Discord or on the forum. For details of Discord, look in the show notes or on the sidebar of the website at creightoncrowbar.com. If you'd like to follow us or other people on Twitter, visit twitter.com. If you'd like to follow us specifically, I'm at C Thurston. That's C-T-H-U-R-S-T-E-N. Tom?
At PCGLudo, which is L-U-D-O.
Pip?
At Philippa War, which is at P-H-I-L-I-P-P-A-W-A-R.
Good job. Mm.
Nice.
Yeah. I'm going to bring a list of other people next time.
We've all got that to look forward to.
What? It'll be nice.
It will be nice. We'll also have Tom here to be baffled by the entire thing.
Oh, yeah. Well, I can't pretend to be him anymore, much as that went badly. Mm. Anyway.
Let's stop the podcast. Thanks for listening, everybody.
Yes.